Good morning and welcome to Grand Rounds. It's my pleasure to present Dr. Lawrence Halpern. Lawrence did his undergraduate work at Tufts University and went to medical school at Penn. He was an intern at Graduate Hospital. I also was at Graduate Hospital, but a few years before him. He did his residency in ophthalmology at Washington University of Medicine in St. Louis and did a fellowship in retinal and vitreous disease at Barnes Hospital, Washington University in St. Louis. He's certified by the National Board of Medical Examiners as a diplomat and the American Board of Ophthalmology. He has multiple teaching appointments. He's a volunteer assistant professor at Ophthalmology University of Miami, associate affiliate professor at the Charles Schmidt School of Medicine. He's the course director in ophthalmology and retinal disease at Charles Schmidt School, FAU School of Medicine, and is the clinical assistant professor of ophthalmology and voluntary at the Herbert Wertheim College School of Medicine at FIU. He's had multiple honors and awards and has participated in multiple areas of research, clinical research. Currently, he is a partner in the Retinal Group of Florida. This morning, Dr. Halpern's talk is entitled Retina and the Anti-VEGF Era, Age-Related Macular Degeneration. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome Dr. Halpern. Okay.
Thank you very much. Let's see here. Okay. So, Ken, thanks for asking me to speak. I really appreciate it. This is my pleasure to be here and participate in teaching here. As Ken was walking up, he said to me, "By the way, what is VEGF?" Which is so funny how in different parts of medicine, we really have no clue what other people are doing. VEGF is like basically our entire world in retina. It's what we do all day long, and I'll talk to you guys about it. And I'm sure there's 100 things that Ken does all day long every day that I have no idea and can't remember or probably never even learned. So that's why these talks are so important. By the way, feel free to raise your hand or yell out. I don't mind interruptions. So I'm in a big retina group. We have 11 retina surgeons in our practice over Palm Beach and Broward County. We've been around for 35 years or more. Here's my email and cell phone number. If you ever see a picture of something wacky in eye or retinal disease and you want to text it to me and ask what it is or figure out how to get a patient taken care of, you can get in touch with me anytime. We have done over 100 FDA-monitored clinical trials. Clinical trials moved from university setting to private practice setting about 15 years ago when they realized that they could do the studies twice as fast for a third the price. And so our patients have benefited because we've had a lot of new cutting-edge technology that we've been able to offer them through clinical trials, including what we're talking about today, which is vascular endothelial growth factor. So I thought I'd take a little tangent for one moment and talk about ICD-10 and the disaster that it's causing all of us. People in training probably don't realize it because for them this is the new reality. But for us, we have been coding the exact same way for 30 years, 35 years, and now the coding changed. And so it's really turned everybody's practice upside down. It has really turned ours upside down. And I love when the government tells us it's going to be better for us to do it this way, and it probably will be ultimately. I do find it amusing, some of the changes, like they drill down really deep in certain really obscure diseases. So there's 14 different diagnoses for different codes for a diagnosis that I use once every 3 years. And then macular degeneration, which over half of our patients have, there's one code. Not even left and right. It's just one code for both eyes. So it's really amazing how, you know, sort of foolish and lack of insight they have into what we do every day. And I'm sure everybody in each specialty has their own examples of how ICD-10 is driving them bananas. But anyway, so let's talk about first macular degeneration. People say there's two things that you can't avoid. That's death and taxes. Well, the third one might be macular degeneration. I believe that if you live long enough, everybody would get some amount of macular degeneration. Now, some people get it in their 40s, and some people might not get it until their 140s. And so if they only live to 110, then they don't get macular degeneration. But I think it's part of our aging natural aging process to develop at least some early macular degeneration. Over 7 million patients 40 years old and older have some form of macular degeneration, and almost 2 million have a late stage of macular degeneration, either geographic atrophy, which is an atrophy of the pigment layer underneath the retina, or CNV, choroidal neovascularization, which is a growth of blood vessels that we'll be talking about today. And it's the leading cause of blindness in people over 50 years old in the industrialized world. So it is of epidemic proportions. It is essentially macular degeneration is a white person's disease. No one really knows exactly why, but the retina lies on top of a bed of pigment called the retinal pigment epithelium. And the darker the pigmentation of the skin, the thicker and more substantial the monolayer of retinal pigment epithelium. And maybe that's why people of color don't get much, if any, macular degeneration. So it's really an aging white disease. There's a lot of risk factors that people throw darts at. Smoking is definitely no good. Pretty much anything that's not good for your heart is not good for your macula, for macular degeneration. So smoking is probably for sure. Family history, maybe. Hypertension, barely. Cataract surgery, really unlikely that that has anything to do with it. Light exposure. Patients say, oh, I should have worn sunglasses when I was younger. I'm not really sure there's really very little data to support that light exposure causes macular degeneration. So we're going to talk about wet macular degeneration and then this sort of current state of affairs and then some new treatments. And then we're going to talk about diabetic retinopathy as well. So this is a histopathology or histology of the retina and the multiple cell layers. And then this is a picture of what we use all day long to evaluate the macula. And this is optical coherence tomography, OCT. OCT is like a ultrasound or sonogram, but instead of using sound, it uses a thin beam of laser light. The laser, of course, is at a very low energy, so it's harmless to the eye, and so your eye could have thousands of OCTs, and it's completely harmless. But it works by shooting the light at the retina and then sensing the reflection off of the different layers, and it has gotten so good in the past several years that you get almost a macular biopsy where you can literally see the multiple layers of the retina, and this is absolutely critical to our ability to diagnose retinal disease. So things have completely changed with OCT. And of course, as in all fields of medicine, the technology goes hand in hand with the new developments in intervention. And so if we didn't have OCT, we wouldn't have the drugs that I'm talking about today, or at least we wouldn't really know how to use them and apply them. So we're talking about angiogenesis. That is, and this applies to angiogenesis in tumors, in macular degeneration, in diabetic retinopathy. Angiogenesis is the same throughout the body. This work was first envisioned and dreamt up by Judah Folkman, who was an oncologist at Harvard Medical School. And for the first at least 10 years of his career, he talked about that there was a chemical that was making blood vessels grow in tumors. He kind of knew in the back of his mind that there were blood vessels growing inside the eye in diabetic retinopathy and that there might be some parallel. For the first 10 years that he would talk about this at meetings, I've read that he was like literally laughed out of the room, although I can't imagine that because he was one of these sort of real true gentlemen. But people didn't believe a word that he said about it. He has since won the Nobel Prize and changed medicine forever with Avastin and the drugs that we're talking about, that I'm going to talk about today. Angiogenesis has a vascular and an extravascular component, and treatment attacks both of those components in a way that we try to get the blood vessels to stop growing and stop leaking. Choroidal neovascularization is the process of the eye forming new blood vessels, probably in response to ischemia. And the ischemia is more than likely microvascular, where the capillaries actually under the retina. So there's retina, then there's the pigment layer, and then there's a second circulation called the choroid. So the retina has, even though it's only, 10 cell layers thick, it has such an incredibly high metabolic rate that it actually has two separate circulations. It has the retinal blood vessels for the inner retina, and then it has the choroidal blood vessels for the outer retina or deeper retina. And choroidal neovascularization are new blood vessels that are growing up from the choroid. I don't know if this works. So growing up from the choroid and the blood vessels are growing because of ischemia. The ischemia that the eye perceives causes the release of VEGF, vascular endothelial growth factor. VEGF is present in our eyes at birth, and I'm sure during fetal development, and is critical, let's say, for the retinal blood vessels to grow from the optic nerve out through the retina to the retinal periphery, is regulated by vascular endothelial growth factor, VEGF. And everybody, we all have VEGF in our eye in a normal state at an extremely low level. As people age and there's a relative ischemia in the eye senses the ischemia and the VEGF is released in an increased level. And the VEGF does not help, however. It is an aberrant process. And the blood vessels in the choroid sense the increase in VEGF and they start growing. They can't help it, right? And so they start growing in a network underneath the retina. But the vessels are new vessels, and they are very fragile, and they break open. And in the upper right, you can see in the retinal photograph that they start bleeding. And on the picture, which we'll talk about in a minute, they start leaking fluid. So the blood vessels bleed and leak into and under the retina, causing vision loss. This is the OCT that I talked about before, and instead of the retina lying on top of the bed of pigment, as it is in the far left part of the photo, there's a space in between the bright white line on the bottom, that's the pigment, and the retina, which is now up floating in the breeze because of subretinal fluid and exudate and blood that develops and causes severe vision loss. And up until not that long ago, like 12 years ago, this was the leading cause of blindness, wet macular degeneration, and we had really no viable treatment. We would use hot laser to cauterize the bleeding, but the laser created scarring and was slightly less destructive than the pathological process itself. And so that was a poor but only option through the early 1990s. Then we developed cold laser, which was Visudyne photodynamic therapy, where we would infuse a photoactivated dye intravenously, and then a very low powered laser to turn the dye on. It was a great idea that has very little efficacy, and so that went by the wayside, and we rarely use hot laser or cold laser anymore, although we still have it and we still use it occasionally, very occasionally. The age of anti-VEGF began with the approval first of Macugen in early 2000s, which was a weak drug with poor efficacy, but then Avastin and Lucentis and Eylea became the mainstays of our practice. The three drugs, we could talk for days or weeks about the differences or lack of difference between the three drugs, and so I'm not going to go into that right now, but we have three different drugs that we use that are anti-VEGF. So in the state of macular degeneration, there's relative ischemia. The eye starts overproducing vascular endothelial growth factor. The blood vessels under the retina sense the VEGF and start to grow abnormally. The patient has symptoms. The symptoms are loss of vision, distortion of vision where straight lines become curved or wavy, or blank spots in the vision. Hopefully we see the patient early before significant vision loss, and we begin injecting anti-VEGF drugs. These are the three anti-VEGF drugs that counteract the increase in VEGF. Intravitreal injections are a huge part of our practice. I give injections all day long. I'm 100% sure that many of the people that you've seen are already getting injections or have gotten them in the past. I myself have given tens of thousands of intravitreal injections in my career. I started out giving antivirals for CMV retinitis in the days of uncontrolled HIV, and gave thousands of injections in the 1990s for CMV retinitis. Thankfully, CMV has disappeared, and I myself had a little bit of a lull of injections where there was a gap of several years where there was no CMV retinitis to treat, and we didn't have the anti-VEGF drugs, and so I was giving very few injections just for the odd bacterial infection and this and that. And then the anti-VEGF drugs came into being, and now we give probably more injections than we did during the HIV days. The patients can complain about the injections a lot, and so it does take a lot of talking to the patient to convince them, at least for the first one. And then once they realize that it's not as bad as it sounds, they usually are okay with it. I try to always treat the patient the first day that I see them, because nobody gets calmer as they're thinking about their next week intravitreal injection the first time. The anxiety, of course, builds and builds and builds. And so we have drug in our office at all times. We also have samples of medication in our office. So if the insurance doesn't work out, we can treat the patient with a sample and don't have to charge anybody and don't have to get reimbursed. So we can always start the treatment that first day. So the anxiety is for 10 minutes until they actually have the injection and realize it's really not that bad. I tell them it's like getting your blood drawn. You know how like when the needle goes in your arm, it like aches for a second, but then once it's in, you don't really feel it. And coming out, you don't really feel it. And so it's really like that. It's sort of a deep ache, and I'm pretty confident that I can make 100% of people comfortable with the injection and the injection process. Some people take a lot more effort than others, but everybody gets through it. And it is a critical thing to do because it keeps people from losing their sight. Macular degeneration was the leading cause of loss of vision in people over 50, and now it's far from it, and that's because of these injections. So why do we give injections in the eye? Why can't it be by eye drop? Well, the problem is in the choroid. So an eye drop has to get through your cornea or conjunctiva and sclera, and anterior chamber and vitreous cavity, and also to get through the retina and the retinal pigment epithelium to get all the way back to the choroidal circulation. And so a drug that you put on the surface of your eye in a drop, which, by the way, there is a clinical trial for a drop for this for wet macular degeneration, it's got a really high bar. It's going to be really tough to get enough drug all the way back to the source of the disease. So why do we give injection? And so why don't we give the drugs systemically? Well, these drugs, like Avastin, you can't give Avastin by mouth because the enzymes and acid and everything in your stomach would kill the antibody. And these are all the drugs are either Avastin antibody or Lucentis and Eylea are antibody fragments or some version thereof. And so orally wouldn't work. And so you'd have to give it intravenously, which is obviously somewhat inconvenient to spend years on periodic intravenous treatment. And second of all, and most importantly, is the systemic toxicity that we avoid by intravitreal injections. So the reason that we give intravitreal injections is because we can. Everybody would give their version of an intravitreal injection. If you could give a medication and only treat the infection and bacteria without treating your whole body and exposing your kidneys and your ears and everything to an antibiotic or the same thing in GI or cardiology, if anybody could give medication just to the organ and not to the rest of the body, if they could, they would. But there's only a couple people that can do that, a couple fields that can do that, and I'm in that field where we can deliver medication in the eye, and at least 99% of it stays inside the eye. There are some systemic side effects of the treatment, but very little. We can also give much higher dose than the body could tolerate systemically. So Lucentis, just as an example, binds to the vascular endothelial growth factor and prevents interaction with its receptors and stops the cascade of the stimulus for the abnormal blood vessels to grow and leak. And this is one of the hallmark studies that was done to get FDA approval for Lucentis, which was the first extremely effective anti-vascular endothelial growth factor, anti-VEGF drug. And the average patient gained 6 letters, which does not sound like a lot, but that's a miracle. And the average patient without drug lost 15 letters. So this is basically gaining 1 line on the eye chart versus losing 3 lines for the sham control. The same thing in another study for Lucentis. So it is, in my opinion, the penicillin of the 21st century. It's a Nobel Prize-winning drug and concept that we can inject medication in the eye and stop blood vessels from growing and get people to get their vision back. The most important thing, by the way, in both diabetes and macular degeneration is starting treatment early, because you see that the average is getting better by 1 line. So if you come in to the office for the first time and your vision is 20/30 and you're 2 lines from 20/20 and you get an injection and you get 1 line better, now you're 20/25 and you're probably going to stay like that for your whole life. If you come in and you're 20/200 because you've had the condition for 2 or 3 months and you've had a lot of loss of vision and you only get 1 line better, now you're 20/100 for the rest of your life. So the starting point of where the treatment starts is the really determining factor of where it's going to end up. Here's an example of a miraculously good success of a patient that started with count fingers, which means on the eye chart, the giant E is 2400. And if you can't even see the giant E, then you're count fingers, meaning a couple fingers in front of your face. So the patient started count fingers because they had blood in their central macula. After a year of injections, they were back to 20/40, mainly because the bleeding stopped and the blood absorbed and the vision recovered. So VEGF is really an incredible frontier. It is incredibly successful. The side effects and complications of injections are extremely rare. The worst complication is intraocular infection. And although it is incredibly serious, it is frequently treatable. My personal experience is a rate of approximately 1 in 6,000 injections gets an infection. And of those, about half do really quite well. We catch it really early, take a sample, and inject antibiotics in the eye, and the infection goes away quickly, and they get back to their baseline vision. So the chance of really losing vision as a complication of injections is under 1 in 10,000 per injection. The downside to injections is they have to be repeated, because an injection, the patient thinks of an injection as a vaccine. They think, oh, I'm going to get one injection and I'm cured. But the truth is, the injection is just like taking a pill. And so, thankfully, you don't have to take the pill and get an injection in your eye every day or twice a day in order for the drug to work. But you do have to get it periodically, and so the injections come about every 4 weeks or to as little as every 10 weeks, depending on what the patient needs. So the next frontier is, I think, two things. Number one, how do we get patients back their vision when they do present legally blind with 20/200 vision? And we know that the anti-VEGF drugs, sometimes the patient will get back to 20/40 and have driving vision and reading vision, recognize faces, but many times they won't. And so we have to figure out how to get back vision for people who have lost vision by the time they're presenting, number one. And number two, can we figure out some long-acting delivery system in order to reduce the frequency of injections? So one of them is a drug delivery system being developed by Genentech. It is right now in clinical trial. We're actually recruiting for this trial. It's called Ladder. It's a refillable port. This device gets inserted in the eye on the lower left. We make a small opening in the white of the eye and insert the device. And the device has a reservoir, and the tip of the reservoir is made of titanium. And don't ask me how, but they make little tiny canals in the titanium that are big enough for the Lucentis molecule to go through at a controlled rate. And the Lucentis molecule, over the course of months, is released through that device that remains in the eye for as long as we leave it there. It is an ingenious device, and it is refillable in the office with a needle. I think the coolest part of the technology is there's a needle that is a 33-gauge needle through which you can wash out what's in the reservoir and refill the reservoir with new drug all in one plunge and squirt. And it's really a remarkable thing, and where the trial just opened and we're just starting to recruit patients. Gene therapy, stem cell therapy are both possibilities in macular degeneration and are exciting opportunities. One possibility might be that we could insert a gene into the retinal pigment epithelium, the pigment layer under the retina, and make the pigment cells produce Lucentis, anti-VEGF. And so instead of getting injections all the time, maybe our cells in our eye would produce the drug. Obviously, that's a little bit of a problem if you ever want it to stop producing, because how do you turn that off? And there's, you know, all kinds of potential issues, but it is an exciting area of research. There's another drug that's in development that is anti-platelet-derived growth factor, PDGF. From Optotec, and that's another trial that we're currently enrolling that is attacking another part of the cascade of abnormal blood vessels growing underneath the retina, choroidal neovascularization. One is based on the VEGF that is making the blood vessels grow, and then PDGF is another aspect of the problem. I'd like to change gears. But I'd first like to see if anyone has any questions or comments about the macular degeneration part. Yes?
As a primary care, when I'm doing
So drusen are the early aging spots that develop around the retinal pigment epithelium as a sign of early macular degeneration. The way that we see is our outer retinal layer has photoreceptors, rods and cones. And the rods and cones have discs that have the photo elements, the vision elements in them, and those discs are constantly being produced and shed and regenerated. And in that process, by the way, our retina has two circulations, because you know how, like, you ever run through the airport, like carrying two suitcases under your arms, and you get there and you feel like your heart's going to explode? Well, that's what our retina is doing even when we're sleeping. Our retina's metabolic rate is insanely high. And because the metabolic rate is high, there's a tremendous amount of garbage. And the pigment layer cleans up all the garbage. And drusen is a sign that the pigment layer is not cleaning up the garbage efficiently and fast enough. And so garbage is collecting. And that's what drusen is. And the drusen are more threatening the closer they are to the center of the macula, which is called the fovea, which is where we get our 20/20 vision from. So peripheral drusen are less threatening than central drusen. But the truth is, without dilation and binocular slit lamp microscopy, where we're looking through a microscope with both eyes with the pupil dilated, and without the OCT, that sort of retinal biopsy photograph, without having all that information, it would be hard for me with a direct ophthalmoscope to say this person definitely has drusen, this person has yellow spots that are really not drusen, there's something else. So there's a lot of things that look like yellow spots in the macula that I don't know that I could tell one cause from another without doing all the stuff that we do all day long looking in patients. So I think it's hard in a non-ophthalmology office to make that determination. But to answer your question, the more central they are, the more threatening they are. Yes. Yes. Yes, please.
Comments about the use of statins and omega-3 fatty acids in treatment and or prevention?
Great question. So the question is about statins and omega-3 fatty acids, fish oils. So the statins, both of those were thought to be the next frontier in preventing progression of macular degeneration. I said early on that the statin, that anything that's good for our heart is also good for our macular degeneration. And so statins would be part of that. And so the question is controlling cholesterol or all the magic stuff that statins do? I don't have to tell you guys all the things that they do and maybe some things that we don't even understand yet that they do. Statistically, there's probably some suggestion that it helps, but it's not as strong as we once thought. Omega-3 fatty acids were, I was so confident that omega-3 fatty acids were going to be protective in macular degeneration and other retinal diseases for that matter, that I actually started people on them even before the age-related eye disease study, ARIDS study number 2, came out testing omega-3 fatty acids in dry macular degeneration, drusen and all this. And once that study came out and showed that omega-3 fatty acids showed no statistical benefit, I've given up on it. So I don't know if the study is right, but it is the only study that's been done that is of value and was done well and large enough, and probably no one will ever do it again. So it's international units, right? I think 1,200. Yes.
Are there any patients who do not qualify to have these injections?
So the question is, are there people that can't have the injection for whatever reason? So there are, not many. But there are a few. For one thing, if somebody has ocular surface disease, if they have conjunctivitis or if their eyelashes are infected, that's called blepharitis. You don't want to go putting a needle inside their eye, and even though we're prepping the eye with betadine, you don't want it's the risk of infection would be too great. So if they have any kind of an active infection, their eye surface has to be treated and clean and stable in order to have the injection safely. Other than that, not really. Systemically, we think that, let's say, people that have had a recent stroke or myocardial infarction may be depending on their systemic VEGF levels for collateral blood vessel development, and injecting anti-VEGF in your eye where a tiny percentage of that gets into your systemic circulation, could that impede your collateralization process, which is probably VEGF dependent? I think reasonable people could argue whether or not that is truly the case. I think most people don't stop injections for recent MI or stroke. And so that would be the other consideration. Ken?
So if people are on anticoagulants, if they're on warfarin, if they're on antiplatelet drugs, they're much more likely to bleed into their eyes when you inject into the vitreous or not?
So in several tens of thousands of injections, I've had the odd infection, 1 in 5 or 6,000. I've had 1 vitreous hemorrhage and 1 retinal tear. So, and you can imagine how many macular degeneration patients are on anticoagulant, like probably half of them at least. So the answer is no. The place that we go through the eye, which is through the white part, through the conjunctiva and sclera, but it's in an area that's relatively avascular, and we do complex retinal surgery, and I never stop patients' anticoagulation. So the days of, we used to do this, have the primary care physician admit the patient to the hospital, put them on heparin, stop the, you know, do that whole thing, and then, you know, stop the heparin for 6 hours and do a quick vitrectomy, that's all gone, because there's so much good data that the risk of bleeding even during complicated vitrectomy is so small that anticoagulation is perfectly safe. The other question, which we get called about regularly, is anticoagulation dangerous for causing bleeding in diabetic retinopathy or macular degeneration? And it is, but why is the patient on anticoagulation? I think everybody is so sensitive now to putting their patient on anticoagulation really only when they need it, and to make sure they're on the correct one and not more than they need. And so if somebody has AFib and they're going to have a stroke and die if they're not on Coumadin, and maybe the risk of bleeding in their macula is increased while they're on Coumadin, so then the question is, well, what should we do? Well, I think the answer is you do what's best to preserve the patient's life, and we'll deal with the eye. And so if they might bleed, well, we can start them on injections. And the anti-VEGF drugs are way stronger than the anticoagulation. And once we calm down the bad blood vessels and they retract and stabilize, there's really no risk of bleeding. So we have very little risk or problems with bleeding with patients that are on anticoagulation. All right, so I'd like to go through a little bit the other side of VEGF. The first side was the underside of the retina, the choroidal blood vessels leaking and bleeding because of increased VEGF in macular degeneration. Now I'm talking about the surface blood vessels, the retinal blood vessels, leaking and bleeding and growing in diabetic retinopathy. Diabetic retinopathy is the leading cause of blindness overall. I told you macular degeneration is the leading cause of blindness in people over 50. Diabetes is the leading cause of blindness in the entire population. And we all are fully aware of how big of a problem it is and how many people are diabetic. And there's a special segment of the population that really needs our help on this, because the diabetics who have worse care are more likely to have end organ damage and blindness, because they are disadvantaged socioeconomically and don't have insurance and don't understand how to access the healthcare system, and therefore are predisposed to poorly controlled diabetes, which is then predisposes them to severe diabetic retinopathy and loss of vision, which, by the way, has been a complete disaster, right? Because they're socioeconomically disadvantaged and they don't take good care of themselves, and then they go blind, and then what happens? So when I first got here in 1990, I told everybody, and I'll tell you guys, that we never turn a patient away for any reason. And so if you ever have a patient that doesn't have insurance and they're having vision problems and they're diabetic, call me up and we'll see them. We'll figure it out. We have free drug in the office. We have lasers that are sitting there doing nothing that we can use. So we can take care of a lot of what they need with little or no cost. And in a pinch, we can get the operating room to let us operate on someone if they need a vitrectomy for diabetic retinopathy. So we can get everybody taken care of. So if you're ever in a pinch and you can't figure something out about how to take care of someone, call me and I can always figure it out. So we're interested, when we get referred a patient with diabetes, we're interested in what type, the duration, are they insulin dependent, how long have they had it, and how's their control been? Because that all impacts their risk factors for getting diabetic retinopathy. And back to you, we will communicate everything that we find and what we need to do. Motivation is the last thing on this slide, and most of the patients will say that they're most afraid of going blind. And people don't realize that if their liver's not working very well, they're pretty miserable. But for some reason, everybody thinks, I don't care what happens to me as long as I don't go blind. That's what every patient says. And we can use that as a motivating factor for diabetics that aren't taking good care of themselves and talk to them about how they can change the outcome and course of what happens to their vision if they get on the bandwagon and take good care of their blood sugars and exercise and lose weight and all the things they need to do, as difficult and challenging as it is to do those things. And I've really developed a lot of compassion for my diabetic patients. I think early in my career, I was like, how come you don't just take care of yourself? I didn't really sort of understand how hard it was. And I think when you really get to know diabetic patients and you really sort of feel for them and what a challenge it is every minute of every day to be checking your blood sugar and having to think about, how much did I eat? Am I feeling well today? And, all that kind of stuff that you folks deal with all day long. I really see it as part of the disease and part of the challenge. So I don't blame people for not taking good care of themselves, but sometimes having the threat of going blind can be quite good motivation. Diabetes and diabetic retinopathy is really rampant now, and I don't have to teach you about the end organ damage of kidneys and heart and eyes and peripheral neuropathy and everything else. But again, the patient's fear of blindness can be helpful to get them to sort of, quote, see the light. Sorry, Don. So the pathophysiology of diabetic macular edema. There's retinal microvascular damage that occurs from high blood sugar. That leads to relative retinal hypoxia. When the eye senses not enough oxygen, it releases vascular endothelial growth factor in an increased concentration. That makes the existing blood vessels of the retina the capillaries of the retina have increased vascular permeability, and if the VEGF gets high enough, the blood vessels will actually start to grow, leading vascular leakage, diabetic macular edema, and proliferative diabetic retinopathy. So there's really two main kinds of diabetic retinopathy. There's non-proliferative and proliferative. The non-proliferative is microaneurysms, retinal hemorrhages, dot and blot hemorrhages, and eventually leakage of fluid in the macula called diabetic macular edema. If the VEGF level goes high enough, the blood vessels actually grow off the surface of the retina. That's called retinal neovascularization, as opposed to choroidal neovascularization. That's macular degeneration. Retinal neovascularization is diabetic retinopathy. Every diabetic patient, there's all sorts of rules and regulations that, you know, a type 1, you know, 14-year-old diabetic doesn't really have to rush to see an ophthalmologist right away because they probably have been diabetic for, you know, 12 hours from the time of diagnosis. So that's different. But any adult that develops diabetes should start having annual eye exams right away to get in the habit of it. And if we do a couple eye exams, maybe before they absolutely were necessary, I'll trade that off for making sure that everybody gets exams. The problem is that over about half of patients that should have annual exams in diabetes don't get the exam. So we do an extensive examination, obviously. The first thing I learned and the first thing I teach medical students now is to use the direct ophthalmoscope. And the direct ophthalmoscope is an interesting device. And when you're a medical student and maybe even when you're in practice, it appears to be a useful thing. I can tell you that in my practice, when we had our first medical student start to spend time with us in the office, it took us 3 weeks to find a working direct ophthalmoscope. We don't use direct ophthalmoscopes. I haven't touched a direct ophthalmoscope, not counting with the medical students, since my first day of residency, except when we would have to examine patients at the bedside. So it's just not a great way to get enough information to take care of people in 2015. So part of the problem is that there's a very narrow view of the eye. So on the left, you can see that's your sort of cone of view with a direct ophthalmoscope versus on the right, what we can see through a dilated pupil. And really, in truth, we can see the entire retina with our various equipment. We also have extensive imaging, including the OCT that I showed you for macular degeneration. We do fluorescein angiography, which is we inject dye intravenously. It's a vegetable-based dye, and it circulates, and we take photographs of the dye circulating in the retina, how fast it gets there, how extensively it circulates, and whether or not new blood vessels are growing. The classification of diabetic retinopathy is the non-proliferative and the proliferative, and the early findings are some microaneurysms in the retina and speck hemorrhages. What are the chances that with a direct ophthalmoscope I could detect early diabetic retinopathy in a patient? And I would say my chances in an undilated pupil are probably 2 or 3 out of 10. I'd be worse than 50-50 chance of detecting the diabetic retinopathy in an office setting, not in my office, just an office setting, versus what we can do in our office. So it's really not, you know, where we want to be nowadays with our current available technology. Again, the pathophysiology, the retinal capillaries develop stuff that blocks the capillaries from communicating with the surrounding tissue, relative ischemia, fluid develops, microaneurysms, which are outpouching of the blood vessels. The capillaries develop this stuff that affects the endothelial cells of the capillary, and protein deposits develop. That's the hard exudate that you can see, the hemorrhages that you can see, and the microaneurysms all come from the primary process of thickening of the capillary wall, which starts out with from hyperglycemia. On the left is a normal OCT that shows a normal macula, and on the right, fluid-filled cysts from fluid collecting in the macula, diabetic macular edema, the most common cause of loss of vision in diabetes. This is a fluorescein angiogram, the dye test with photographs that show capillary dropout. So in the picture, near the optic nerve and the retinal blood vessels, you sort of see that it's lighter gray, and then out to the side, it's very dark. It's dark because there's no dye. So the capillaries close, and there's no circulation, and the lack of circulation causes VEGF upregulation. VEGF upregulation leads to leaking and bleeding blood vessels. When do diabetic patients need to be seen? They need to be seen, except for the young, the very young diabetic and that are pediatric age, they need to be seen promptly, and then we can decide how often they need to be followed. And the reason for that is we want to treat diabetic patients when we think there's a problem and when they think that they're fine. So when we think they're fine and the patient thinks they're fine, well, then we see them maybe once a year, maybe even less, maybe even every few years, depending on where they are in their diabetes and how good they are at controlling it. By the time the patient says, I have blurred vision, they've had diabetic retinopathy for probably 3 years and probably needed treatment 2.5 years ago. And now we're playing catch up, and they've had a lot of capillary loss and a lot of retinal damage, and it's very tough to get their vision back. And so why don't patients come in? There's a variety of reasons, part of which is fear. They're so afraid of going blind. You'd think they'd come in to the ophthalmologist, but maybe they don't want to find out what's going to happen, so then they don't come into the ophthalmologist. So it becomes really a double-edged sword, but around 50% of people don't come in that need to come in to get seen. So what can we do together to reduce the risk of loss of vision from diabetic retinopathy? Controlling blood sugar is a huge benefit. Patients that are having end organ damage already, like renal malfunction, definitely are at much higher risk for loss of vision. And people with peripheral neuropathy, the same thing. And the same for us. When we see patients that have diabetic retinopathy, we do everything we can to make sure that they are under intensive control with a primary care physician, because better glucose control is going to do a lot to help us. So here is a picture of growing blood vessels on the surface of the retina from upregulation of VEGF. Those blood vessels are fragile, and they break open and bleed, and the patient has sudden severe loss of vision. This is treatable first with laser. Here is a picture of laser treatment to the retina in a scatter-type pattern that diminishes the VEGF level, and when the VEGF level drops, the growth of blood vessels stops, and the vessels shrink and stabilize. So diabetic macular edema is first treated with laser, and second is treated with the anti-VEGF drugs. So the same drugs that we use in macular degeneration are also FDA approved for use in diabetic retinopathy. The abnormal blood vessels are proliferating or leaking because of upregulation of VEGF. We start injections of anti-VEGF. The VEGF goes away, and the blood vessel wall stabilizes and shrink, and actually the thickening in the capillary wall diminishes, and circulation normalizes, and leakage stops, hemorrhages absorb, and vision stabilizes and or improves. So the anti-VEGF drugs are very important in treating diabetic retinopathy. And a similar graph to what we saw with macular degeneration is present with diabetic retinopathy. The upper line is treatment with anti-VEGF drugs, gaining 12 letters of vision compared to baseline, which is a tremendous amount, versus less than one line, I'm sorry, 12 letters or two and a half lines of vision versus maybe one line of vision with standard laser treatment. So the injections in diabetic patients are extremely valuable. You wonder, how long do you have to give the injections for? Is it for life? Is it for just a couple years? Is it just a couple injections? And the answer is all of the above. It depends on how the patient responds to the injections in the first place. I've had diabetics that I've given two injections to, and I have diabetics that I've given 30 so far, and it's not stopping anytime in the near future. So it just depends on what they need. We give them the fewest number of injections possible to control the disease and get their vision back without giving them more than they need. The other thing that we can do when things are going really badly is vitrectomy, when they are bleeding and the injections are not enough to clear out the blood or to stop scar tissue development. We can do surgery on diabetic patients to cauterize the bleeding blood vessels, take the blood out of the eye, and try and stabilize things. But the patient failed themselves, the medical system failed the patient, or however you want to look at it. If they get to the point where they need vitrectomy, then we miss the opportunity to prevent them from having severe loss of vision. So the goal is to catch them way before they need surgery to prevent the severe loss of vision. New developments in diabetic retinopathy are similar for those in macular degeneration. Long-term delivery devices that maybe you could implant a device that could deliver drug for 6 months or a year and not require constant injections has the potential of working, and other things until we, you know, advance our treatment of diabetes. Just like HIV, when we learn how to control diabetics and their blood sugars are normalized by whatever means, we will be out of the business of caring for diabetic retinopathy, and I'm not worried about that. When I was a resident, I wasn't going to go into retina because in the 1980s they were curing diabetes, and I thought the field of retina was going to be washed up, and that turned out not to work out so well for the diabetic population. And you know, maybe one day we'll cure diabetes. Don't worry about us. We'll have other stuff to do. So I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. The diabetic patients are really close to our hearts, and whatever we can do to work together to tackle the trouble that diabetic patients get, the better for everybody. Questions about the diabetes part? Everyone has to go. Okay, great. Ken, thanks for inviting me. Okay.